You're listening to a podcast of Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers that airs every Monday from 2 to 3 on the Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new interview with Vermont poet Sidney Lee, who has two new books out and has just finished his term as poet laureate for the state of Vermont. Sidney Lee is author of 11 collections of poetry, a novel, and three books of naturalist essays. He founded the New England Review in 1977 and edited it until 1989. His poetry collection, Pursuit of a Wound, was one of three finalists for the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. The preceding volume, To the Bone, New and Selected Poems, won the 1998 Poets Prize. Sidney Lee has received fellowships from the Rockefeller, Fulbright, and Guggenheim Foundations. He has taught at Dartmouth, Yale, Wesleyan, Vermont, and Middlebury Colleges, as well as at Franklin College in Switzerland and the Erzsébet-Lőrinc University in Budapest. His stories, poems, essays, and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The New York Times, Sports Illustrated, and many other periodicals, as well as in more than 50 anthologies. He lives in Newbury, Vermont, and is active both in literacy efforts and in conservation. His 12th poetry volume, No Doubt the Nameless, comes out in March 2016 from Four Way Books. Green Writers Press released a new collection of his short prose reflections, What's the Story, in November 2015. When I spoke to Sidney Lee last week, I began by asking him to read the personal essay, Fool's Day, from What's the Story.
Fool's Day. April 1st, I scout the haze, all hung with birds, and from height of land I survey the face of the mountain off to my east. Its snow leached away but for two or three ribbons of gray. All I'd like to see etched on what I behold, as if it would justify me, as if it would be a sort of poem carved into the blank of snow, is vanished as well. I turn downhill on a long dead farmer's path, which invades the barn. The building writhes astride that lane, while inside the frost that changed dirt floors to marble has melted. A primitive tractor under the empty mow wears lustreless olive drab paint. Why try for stoical thought, distilled and lean? Such effort is inevitably brought to nothing by my senses, which exert their idiot sway. I probe a cobweb funnel with a mitten fist. I taste the piquancy of ancient hay. I smell the musk of powdered animal dung. And I swear I hear the paper banners cry out from chestnut rafters, Army Air Force, keep them flying. The banners go back to the 40s, the rafters much farther. I climb onto the tractor's crackling saddle and grip the wheel. Its wood is still blanched by dead men's sweat. I imagine their hands like some I've long since thought I'd shrugged off for good. They held my shoulders lest I fall like a soldier. The men with the hands had been in the military themselves for the most part. Home after the Second Great War, they gripped the lathered reins of warrior maiden my Shetland pony, as, bitten mouth, she loudly sucked from a riffling trough. I wanted the reins to myself. I wanted to play the Highland warrior. Sentimental now, I'd welcome hands that also enveloped mine on a tractor's wheel, kept softballs and footballs flying, and must have laid me down in the crib. Too soon old, too late smart, my grandmother used to say. I'd best leave right now before my boots sink deeper into muck. From their mud-clad nests and eaves, the springtime swallows leap down to strafe me.
Thank you for reading that, Sid. I loved this. I enjoyed so much of the sense of reminiscence and story that went to all of these short essays. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about when is it that you choose to write prose rather than poetry? Is there any rhyme or reason to that, or does it just kind of come out?
Well, you know, this book is interesting in that respect, and the question is characteristically right on point. Fool's Day is one of four or five poems, and I say that word advisedly, that somehow had not satisfied me over the years. So I decided to On what inner prompting, I have no idea. I decided to see what would happen if I translated them, so to say, into prose, and to find out whether the suppleness of the prose format might accommodate them better than any kind of a poetic format that I had come up with. And that was one example. In fact, that particular essay there was published in a fairly prominent literary magazine as a poem, but I read it in that magazine. I didn't like it very much even then, so it was one of the early ones. And, you know, once I did four or five of these, to my satisfaction, there were a group of others that didn't work out either as prose or poetry, in my opinion, or not yet. Then, strangely enough, or perhaps not so strangely, every motive I had to write seemed to come at me in this short prose format, and so that's the way I wrote. I tend not to write in more than one genre at a time.
Right.
So having started, as I say, with these, as it were, translations, then the rest seemed to follow. And I wrote the book really rather quickly by my standards. So that's how that's the genesis of this format.
Okay. One of the reasons I asked you to read this one is that it encompasses so much of what I regularly appreciate about your work. It has memory, and it has observation, and it has the visceral feeling of the tractor's saddle and the grip of the wheel. It has story like the grandmother, and then there are those swallows, you know, and it's nature is so ever present in your work. So it's all there, and I loved how that came together in this piece.
Thank you.
In another one of your pieces, I wasn't going to ask you to read this one, but you recall a time in the woods when your old friend Creston MacArthur, who has a role in a lot of your work, I recall, he made an analogy that you loved, and actually I loved reading it. He said that a group of nearby chattering barred owls reminded him of a good pack of dogs. And in the piece you write that it was pinpoint accurate. I just wondered if we could talk a little bit about metaphor. What works and what doesn't, and why did that ring so true to you in that moment?
I mean, in a way, I'm sort of an agnostic about metaphor. I mean, I guess my work is full of it, but it's not something that I ever predetermine. You know, it sort of comes after the fact. I just make a one-on-one observation. If that turns out somehow to be metaphorical, then so be it. I think that particular, and this is relevant perhaps to your kind words about the Fool's Day, I think the resonance of that phrase, like so many of his, had to do with the place in which I heard him utter it. You know, I mean, just to hear, I hear the owls, I hear his analogy, and then all of a sudden I'm back in that particular part of the main woods. I could walk to it right today, even though it's rather remote. I remember exactly what it looked like, what the little river going by sounded like, and so on. If that ends up, as I say, being metaphorical, it's unwilled metaphor. Whenever I try and, you know, sort of write a something that has a predetermined metaphorical scheme, I just get bogged down. I can't get anywhere.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's interesting too what you say about the time and the place. You know, I mean, another piece might very accurately have compared chattering barred owls to like a group of people having tea in the city, right? But it would be such a different time and place, it wouldn't work at all. And that makes, you know, the good pack of dogs is perfect in this context.
Well, what can I say? But thank you. Yes, your observation is completely right.
I'm going to ask you to read another one now, if I may. On page 19, Jerry Solitary.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. Here we go. Jerry Solitary. Our neighbor is almost 90, and she's the one I'm visiting. She's Jerry's neighbor, too, and he's the one I'm watching out the window. 15 years old, country to the bone, he's there in the chill, shooting baskets, trying to play some inner-city black kid. His getup is ludicrous. Hoodie, bling, sagging trousers. The boy's expression and his moves are meant to suggest both control and indifference. a fluid leap, an easy spin, a follow-through, his hand dropping as smoothly as if he pulled the window blind. But why the act? How would Jerry suspect he was being studied? Surely he imagined his solitude to be absolute. Out of sight in the barn, his father must stay busy with the milking machines. I hear them drone. Life goes on. Jerry's mother, I've been told, has rented a double-wide trailer down by the bridge. I don't judge. Back 30-some years, when I had a son near Jerry's age myself, I too got divorced. You'd think a kid like Jerry would be angry. My boy was. You'd expect him maybe to pound the ball between shots, but his dribble's lazy, random, and his face looks almost dreamy. If the rusted rim had a net and I were outside closer to him, I'd hear swish after swish. He's accomplished, all right. It might do him good to play for our small school's team, and they could use him. My aged neighbor is, as ever, hard on Jerry's mother. Her husband gave his family everything, she insists, shaking her head, wobbles quivering. I don't answer, since I'm not certain if she means to imply disapproval of the wife's behavior only, or to include some censure of Jerry's appearance, too. His underpants show above the belt of his fat-legged pants. His head's clean-shaven. He may picture himself with neck tattoos. I visit because our neighbor is roomy, half-deaf, and failing by the month. Life goes on. Now, recently, it seems the old lady was hale, and the boy a sweet blonde baby. And I, turning into an elderly man, is the biggest surprise in my life. Like any such kid, no doubt Jerry hopes his parents will reconcile. Darkness settles, only the far mountaintops still bearing light. He can't know I watch him there as he paces off an NBA three-pointer 23 feet from the backboard, or in this case, the side of the barn, which could stand some tending. It's late November. The dooryard earth hard as ice. I want to look away. Jerry must realize his long shot won't go. It will never go.
Thank you so much. I love that piece. Now, to me, this didn't read like something that started off as a poem. This read much more as though it were intended to be prose all along. Is that right?
That's accurate, yes.
Yeah. I love the idea of who, you know, why the act? Who are we when we are alone? And, you know, what are we doing if we're trying on different personas when we're alone?
I don't know if I have a conclusion there. My guess is that, like any of us, you know, we're trying to invent a self to meet the circumstance, and right then his circumstance is one that's clearly very unhappy for him.
Right, right.
So he's affecting cool indifference.
Yeah. Now, even though it didn't read to me like it started out as a poem, there is poetry here. Lines like "by the bridge" and "don't judge," you know, feel like near rhymes that would work in poetry. So does this come from a lifetime of writing poems that will show up in your prose, or are you working at that language, that sentence level language, when you're writing prose as you do with your poetry?
Well, you know, people say, you know, they ask me, what's the difference between your prose work and your poetry? You know, what's the difference between those genres? This is, you know, I'm only answering for myself. I don't know who else I would answer for, but I don't feel that much discontinuity between those genres. It's always a matter of the language. The language is what is generated. You know, if I find what I think is the right phrase to capture a situation, then the language, in a curious way, and I know this sounds hyper-mystical, the language will lead me along toward whatever it is that particular piece of writing wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a kind of a, you know, I've written these too for like outdoor magazines or how-to essays, training pointing dogs or hunting grouse or whatever. That's one kind, that's a whole different matter. But these, I hate the term creative nonfiction, but I suppose people will apply it to these essays. I like to think of them as lyrical essays.
Mm.
And really, that kind of essay really feels very, very close to poetry when I sit down to compose it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, even lyrical essay, it brings it closer to poetry than the term personal essay, which is right. Also what I might have called these. So,
well, that'll do too. I agree, but I call them lyrical essays, I guess, to remind myself of the fact that there is some poetic impetus behind them too.
Yeah. One aspect that I loved about this particular piece was, you know, I always appreciate when an author brings all the five senses into a piece, and you're not standing out by that barn. You can't hear the swish after swish, but you imagine it onto the page. You know, if the rusted rim had a net and I were outside closer to him, I'd hear swish after swish. I loved that you were able to bring that sound into the piece anyway. I like just remembering that as a writer, that we can imagine ourselves into the senses too.
I have a little to add to that. You're quite right.
Now, I wonder if the characters who you write about ever recognize themselves, and is that ever an issue for you?
It's very much an issue for me, and I tend to disguise them, and often I make them composite. Now, this young man that I have in mind is somebody that whose family I know quite well. They're not farmers. The father is, in fact, a contractor, and the mom is a school teacher. But it's not all that likely that any of them will pick up a book of mine and read it. But if they did, I wouldn't want them to feel that they could be easily identified. So I cover the tracks in a way. I always liked Emily Dickinson's line about, you know, tell all the truth, but tell it slant.
Right.
I hope there's truth to this essay and to the observations that it encompasses, but it's not factually true in any literal sort of way.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. The next one I was going to ask you about is It's a Beautiful Day on page 88.
Sure. It's a beautiful day. There's wind down lake from the most brilliant quarter, north-northwest, but it's still gentle enough that the cumuli move slowly, grandly. In the water, low ridges and even jags of cloud show so sharp in reflection, it looks as though they could cut your thumb. It's late this summer, and the river salmon have grown fighting faces for October when the spawn comes on. I can already see them if I dream of standing on the bridge in the village, a thrash and spangle among the shallows, two males having at it below until the weaker one resigns at last and thins out at an angle into the current to fade downstream. On the west bank, the cedar waxwings will throng Mrs. Barton's mountain ashes. Bird is so preternaturally clean and well-groomed, I'll blink. I'll marvel at the berries, too. Red is the reddest thing God made. The light will be the light of light off of waxwing feathers. Once, even if I tried, I could not catch my breath for them. And even in waning August like this, I'd have gazed in wonder along the lake, or down the river, or up into woods, where the feebler maples already show a subtle but eloquent flaring. Below the canopy, the sweet fern has started ineluctably to brown, and in the clearings, the hardhack to purple. Yes, once I'd have gone half mad over such things, filled with a young man's urge, almost catastrophic, to make something of this sensory surfeit, this conifer tang in the northwester's air, cedar water red in the shallower coves, ospreys and eagles wheeling above, screams dropping loud on the densely wooded shores. But you can't bank any of that against your future. Nor could anyone bank the feel of the smoothly grained ash paddle I gripped, made by Kenny, who got good and shot up as he stormed a beach in Normandy, then came home and built himself a cabin deep inland from Big Lake. He stayed there until winter and came back to run the store again, with never another word of that awful conflict. He ran the store well and long and with honor. There was always, of course, the very water, a mere taste of which nearly drove me to frenzy. That craze of longing, that feeling of violent restlessness, it was at best a bother, and worse than ache, a bad one. Yes, I thought a man must get up and do. Do what? Do something. Save all this unsalvageable glory. I now know to do nothing because nothing can be done. Yet what of the double rainbow I saw that time above the dam, for instance, or the otters that played tag with me as I paddled on another lake with my wife, the way they barked at us now and again, but never, it seems, menacingly. What of the sun, which always felt warm as a brick on my back while I plied the canoe? I recall those red tails, 2, 3, 4, 5, good God, it was 6, who would not be flushed from the lamb deer's carcass at the old Dodd farm one late fall, but hunched to their collective shoulders, almost cat-like, and hissed at me until I turned back up the tote road. There's nothing I need to accomplish anymore, if ever there was. It's a beautiful day, and I'll just drift to near shores, have lunch at noon, and take a nap on a beach somewhere. I'm so much saner than once, and grateful for that. It's better. It's better. It's better. It's better to want so much less and hurt so much less. I'm calm as I watch the wind. And yet.
In the end, there's no period, and I thought that was on purpose, probably. Is that on purpose?
Yeah, it's meant to imply a kind of open-endedness. You know, it is somehow, maybe there aren't perhaps a lot of compensations for getting to be a geezer like me. I just turned 73.
Happy birthday.
One, however, is a sense of what is possible and what is not, you know, when you're a attenuated adolescent still with the hormones rushing through every fiber of your being. You know, you just got to do something. And you may not even know what it is.
But I
shouldn't say you. I'm talking about myself. You know, I would sometimes contemplate a natural scene and say, God, this is so gorgeous. What can I do? I got to put it in the bank somehow. And I say, you know, you can't bank any of that against your future. It's there, and you might as well enjoy it for what it is, because there's no keeping it. It's not salvageable in that sense.
Right. You know, what I could relate to, I could relate. And one thing that occurred to me as I was reading this is the discovery of food as you're in your, I don't know, 20s and 30s, and the discovery of cuisine and the excitement of your first kiwi or avocado or Thai food, or, you know, and then all of a sudden you're in your 50s and you're like, eh, it's food. <You know>? It's good.
You know what it reminds me of? And ultimately, this is a good thing. I mean, I'm on record that humility is a virtue, and I really mean it, because if I don't practice it myself, I always end up unhappy. But I remember way back when the first poem I ever had accepted by the New Yorker was accepted. I went to the mailbox and opened it up, and here was this letter from Howard Moss accepting a poem of mine, of all people. And my conclusion was, well, now life is really on a change. You know, I'm in the big time now, and you know, life doesn't change. You still got the same kids, you still got the same job, and that's a good thing. I mean, I've been very blessed in those respects. Now, you know, if I don't know what's going with the contemporary New Yorker. I don't even send poems there anymore, because I don't understand the ones they do publish. But you know, if I get the equivalent, I would say the Atlantic, they do publish me periodically. It's very gratifying, but it's not, you know, it's not the same. It's like, as you were saying about Thai cuisine, the first time I ever tried that, I said, man, I didn't even know this existed in the
right.
world. I'm really getting there. And now I'm delighted to go to a good Thai restaurant. Who wouldn't be? But it's not, doesn't have that sense of climax and possibility that it wants to. That's a very good analogy.
Now, I'm not finished with It's a Beautiful Day. I am not somebody who spends a lot of time in the woods. When I do, I love it, but I'm not somebody who regularly contemplates all of these details. And I just loved reading about the fish, you know, the two males having at it below until the weaker one resigns at last and fins out at an angle into the current to fade downstream. That was beautiful. I thought it also sort of, you said that you don't look for a larger metaphor in any piece, but I don't know, that felt a lot like the sense that this piece is providing, where, you know, we're fighting for that passion and that vigor that we first experienced, you know, and then we kind of, you know, okay, well, I'm going to, like, fade out.
Yeah, I think people point things out to me in my work that make absolute sense to me, and to that extent, you know, I realize that once I put something, if I publish something, then it becomes community property, and another person's take on it is every bit as good as mine. And oftentimes, I've had things pointed out to me by close friends such as Fleeta Brown, who did one of the blurbs on my pre-book. She points out patterns and metaphorical gestures that I swear to God I really wasn't conscious of in the process. I was just, as I say, following the language, and it provided me with these things when they had not been foreordained in my mind by any matter of means.
Yeah.
What you said, salmon, makes perfect sense in the context, yeah.
Yeah, no, and I believe that, you know, that these things just kind of sometimes just happen, and they're probably more organic and more special when they just happen than if we try to put them in there. So you just mentioned Fleeta Brown wrote a blurb on your new collection of poems. You have a collection coming out from Four Way Books in March, is that correct?
That's right. I already have copies of it, but it's official. Pub date is 1 March, yep.
Okay. Before we actually get into talking about that particular collection, I did just want to ask you quickly for your thoughts on publishing with smaller presses. Both Four Way Books and Green Writers Press, which published What's the Story, which we were just talking about, are small presses, and I would call them small presses with large intentions. They both do good work. So what's your experience been with the small presses that you've published with?
Well, I hope never to publish with anybody else in the poetry genre than Four Way Books. They're just a first-rate operation. They got a big jolt in the arm, shot in the arm last year when one of their authors, Greg Pardlow, won the Pulitzer Prize. But they do poetry, and I think more and more that the torch of poetry is going to be passed to so-called small presses. You know, Copper Canyon's the biggest publisher of poetry in the world, but it is technically a small press. My one experience with publishing with a major house, with Macmillan, was such a disaster that I'm never going to take that. I'm never going to take that chance again. So I'm delighted to. To stick with Four Way until they kick dirt in my face. And as for Green Writers Press, I sent this book to a few larger presses, commercial presses, and I got the same response. You know, that we think the writing is gorgeous and this is fun to read, but we don't know how to market it. We don't know. You know, couldn't use it in a classroom. You know, who's its readership and so on. So I knew of Green Writers Press, I guess, by way of having read one or more of their authors, and I'm drawing a blank right now for, well, it's brain cramp of an old guy. But I thought, you know, here is a press which is self-styled as kind of maverick, and even if mine is not a particularly green book, though I'm deeply involved in green causes, still they're enough off the the beaten path that they might go for it. And to my delight, Dee Dee Cummings, the director, liked the book and took it right away. So.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that, and I think she's done a good job promoting it, and I have nothing to complain about.
Yeah, one interview I did recently with another of their authors is Brett Stanshew. Are you familiar with her? She wrote a beautiful book about.
In fact, I read with her up in Burlington one night. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Great. Okay. And I'll just give a shout out to another small Vermont press, which was my press, and that's Windridge Books. So, you know, it's just wonderful to see all these tiny presses.
Windridge is doing great stuff, too. I'm delighted to see this. Vermont's doing so many things so well, that, in my humble opinion, including mounting a presidential campaign, but that's not what this conversation about. That it's really great to see this efflorescence of small publishers. May they be as plentiful as the breweries that are sneaking up around all over the place.
Absolutely. So, Sid, I was going to ask you if you could read some poetry from No Doubt the Nameless. And I was going to actually have you start with The Nightmares You Knew, which is on page 7, which is the poem from which
the title comes. Yep. And also also the cover illustration, which is by my really talented niece, Sonia Lee.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
great. Yes, that's my my younger brother's, one of his twin daughters. The Nightmares You Knew. What would be worse, you wondered, a nightmare you actually pictured? Or incubus, devoid of features, nameless, not even a creature? No doubt the nameless. So you chose a few you could visualize. If that's what you want, the nightmares whispered, and bought a digit-sized, resplendent coral snake that slid all wriggle and toxin inside the house, your mind. The snake was the first to corrupt your slumber. Then they decided upon a different guise altogether. Scorpion, her claws tick-ticking under your bed, you heard. Small wonder you felt so lonely. You felt so oddly accident-prone. Gila monster lay, it seemed stock still, alone, in the dim and dust-balled corner of the room, like a heap of piebald stones. The only sign that he lived, the cold stone's rhythmic pulsing. Shearman called you outdoors. You watched, you winced, recoiling. And the deepest dead of winter, bone-chilling, from red diacritics marking with snow, pale page with umlaut and circumflex of plunder. They made it into a shrike, or to use the argo, a butcher bird who deftly hung cadavers like minuscule vivid flowers on any plant or shrub, whatever offered a thorn. Then another something surfaced which, with a languid turn of her eros tail, riled up the ponds, swampland matriarch fond of flesh, the alligator, all grin and fetor, ruthless. Heavy heels, he trod the verges of Northland forest. Wolverine, possessive, dauntless. He gnawed the wolf off the carcass, whose festering brain he consumed. And what was left, he pissed. Be reminded it was your will that made for all of this. To envision each figure was to make it exist. And you urged all to persist. The nightmares are grateful to you for persisting too, no matter. It's kind of you, they believe, to help them all to prosper.
Thank you very much. I had two reactions to this poem. First of all, I just thought I found the language absolutely incredible. I kept reading it, and then I finally started reading it out loud because it was so much fun to read. But then I thought, wow, that must have been a really bad dream. Did you write this at 3 a.m?
Well, no, but I, you know, it's interesting. You know, you're an acute lady, Sheila. I've got to give you a lot of credit. I have before, and I mean it. The origin of the poem was, in fact, an indescribable dream, one from which I awoke, and I said, well, something strange was going on. You know, I can't name it, but it was terrifying. Either there was no image, there was no sound, there was no sensory recollection. You know, dreams are often very graphic, and so on. And I thought somehow, or half thought, boy, I'd really rather have a dream without something I could actually picture. You know, you can run away from a Wolverine, but something that's completely nameless. That's why I say, you know, what would be worse, something you could actually picture, or an incubus devoid of features, nameless, not even a creature.
Right.
And you say, what would be worse? No doubt the nameless is what I had in mind.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, I don't know what exact hour it was, but the 3 a.m. is metaphorically proper.
Now, I loved the idea of nightmare as character. You know, there's a certain point where they get a pronoun. They decided upon a different guise altogether, the nightmares. They are sentient and they are motivated. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
That was great. Now, how did you come upon this as the title of the collection? Was it what you intended when you submitted the collection to the press, or did you work on that with them?
No, that was what I entitled it, and the reason I did was that, you know, I mean, if you went by the title and by the title poem alone, you would think it's a kind of a gloomy book, but I think like a lot of my books, or most of them, as I arrange them, I hope there's a kind of an upward arc. You know, you go down into the pit of nightmare, but by the
right. By
the end of the poem, I'm in a pretty happy place, contemplating
yeah.
my wife's back as we paddle down the Connecticut River. But I think that I chose No Doubt the Nameless just because it sounded like a good hook. You know, what can he mean by that? You know, I don't think I had any profounder motivation than that.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about that title that I really love for a poetry collection, because so much depends on very specific naming of things.
Well, it's funny because I refer to him in one of my poems in the book. I have a very dear friend who's a Slovene poet named Marian Stroyan. And I sent him the book. I sent him all my books, and he wrote back and he said, "Thank you for sending me No Doubt the Nameless. Isn't that what we're always writing about?" I hadn't thought of it from that angle, but I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah. So I was curious, as I read this collection, if you find that writing poetry brings up more things for you than the non-writing days. So are you likely to remember more of your dreams, let's say, or of your life story, your memories, when you are writing a lot?
Again, I mean, I hate to keep wading into this kind of murky pool as I do, but there is something generative about language itself. You know, if I can get started and write a first line which I think is true to whatever experience it's trying to render, then the rest, in some curious way, takes care of itself. At least with respect to a first draft, it gives me material, and
right.
then after, of course, there's all the revision and getting rid of extraneities and dragging in stuff that probably should have been there but wasn't in the first draft. But it's the language that leads me along. Yes.
Does it bring up new memories ever?
All the time. All the time. And either of these formats that we're talking about today, ultimately, it's not very original of me to say this, because I think Frost said it in different terms. You know, I kind of write poems to find out what I didn't know I knew.
Yeah.
And again, language is a means to that. Certain memories and particularly things I've heard in the past come back to me not that I feel that I have a humdrum life, but, you know, like anybody else, there's grocery shopping and tending grandkids and going down to the store or whatever it may be. And then while I'm in the middle of doing that sort of thing, I'm not necessarily apt to have all my antennae out the way I am when I'm trying to get the words right.
Yeah. I just thought of a new poem that you can write, which is Poet Laureate Shops for Cheese.
I do make a reference to the vanishing of those old cheese wheels you used to see in the general stores of my poems. But I will bear that in mind, and I will dedicate it to you if it ever gets generated.
Okay. The cheese wheel reminds me of a great Anne Lamott story about just how terrible and pathetic readings can be. And you go to your reading and there's this wheel of brie the size of your car tire and two people there.
Oh, dear.
Okay. How about, could you please read the poem Pallid, which I believe is on page 14?
Yes, and that's the one that, in which I refer to my dear friend, Marian Stoyan, whom I just, who said that no doubt the nameless is what we write about all the time. He's a wonderful poet in his own right, with a book coming out in this country shortly. He's also the premier translator of English language poetry into his language, Slovenian. It just beggars the mind. He's done Paradise Lost, Beowulf, The Canterbury Tales, and key poems of Robert Frost. He's an extraordinary fellow.
Did you meet him through Richard Jackson?
No, not at all. I met him through Robert Frost in a curious way. I was teaching in Switzerland in 2001, and I was invited by a Slovenian pen, you know, poet, editor, novelist, to come give a reading on Ljubljana, the capital city. Now, Slovenia is where poets go when they die, if they've been good, because they're held in very high esteem. And I was on the equivalent of National Public Radio. I was on a show that my friend Marian conducted until he retired, a daily 60-minute poetry show, mind you.
Wow.
And we went out afterwards to have a coffee, and he was talking about his work in translation, and he said that Frost was the hardest job he'd had, because he likes to be formed through, and in spoken Slovenian, the I am is almost completely absent. Well, you can imagine how hard it was to do Frost without using iambic feet. He said, but I've got it all, you know, I've been working on it for 25 years. I've got 50 poems now. My publisher's going to do it. And then I got an email from him shortly thereafter in which he said, oh, my publisher made a mistake, and Henry Holt, Frost's American publisher, is going to charge us an arm and a leg for international rights unless I do it in an edition of 200 or fewer. Well, it happened that one of my former students and one of my dear friends is Peter Gilbert, director of the Vermont Humanities Council and also Frost's literary executor, and I just copied my friend's note and said, this is silly and awful. All 2 million men, women, and children bought this book in Slovenian. That's not going to hurt Holt's bottom line. And he arranged to have a much more reasonable fee, $100 or something like that. Well, it took me all of 40 seconds. I just happened to be the right person in the right place. But for him, it redeemed a quarter century of work. So he kept inviting me back to Slovenia to give talks and readings and so on. Every time I came over, he'd translate some more of my poems, and then ultimately I published a collection of poetry in Slovenia, and we became, even more importantly to me, we became very, very dear friends. I loved him, and he's a wonderful, wonderful, brilliant, and humane fellow.
Yeah.
Anyway, this poem is called Pallid, from my wife, from Lake Blade. That's where an annual literary conference I attend takes place, a beautiful jewel-like little lake in the middle of Slovenia. Pallid. Yesterday, my Slovene friend, dear Marian, took me out in the country to an amphitheater fashioned by nature from palest marble. He wanted to show me a second-century petroglyph, Roman rendition of Mithras's bull. The monument gleamed, a sensation, no doubt, but I looked on listless as a lone drab dove hot stone to stone, each one as white as this page I ponder. Now coasting swans on the lake below show a different pallor from paper or boulder or alpine snow. I can't even render absence of color, blank, bare, ivory, wan. My words are black, it's all I can make them. What value in them if we're not together with these sights and bird sounds and countless greens of mountain springs? My banalities gather. Such a waste, I whisper and flinch as a swift kite skims all wing and talon across the water. Its shadow, a menace that flushes some ducks and an undersized heron. My wasted witness. I'll soon be home, but no account of mine will make the things I saw and heard seem true. but what on sensing them I felt no more than these forced lines will tell how terribly I needed you. I'm happy to say that she's coming this year. She's coming with me, so I won't miss her so badly because she'll be with me.
And you'll be able to find the words to describe what you want to describe. I appreciated the narrator's frustration in this piece with his trying to find the right words. And I know that it's built around missing his wife, your wife. But I just thought we could have just a sort of tangential, perhaps, conversation about what you do when you're trying to write and you can't find the words. Do you push through? Do you give up? Do you take a break?
Well, you know, I taught creative writing, if such a thing can be done, for 43 years, and my mantra was the way you get better at writing is by, guess what, writing. And so I just push on. You know, I mean, even if it's going nowhere, I say I'm just going to keep writing until I've assembled enough material that I can reevaluate it and see if there's anything there. But that's what you have to do. You know, if you sit there and ponder, well, I wonder if this poem or this essay will work, then you're never going to get anywhere. You got to have material to work with. So if the words don't come, I just keep pushing along. I mean, ultimately, I may tear up my hair and say, well, I'm done for the day after a few hours. But I try and put in the time. And somebody once said, you know, trust inspiration. If inspiration fails, make that your theme. I guess I did the latter here with ballad. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, many of your poems concern an outdoor life and a poet's desire or need to record it. And I'm about to commit the crime of typecasting here or stereotyping, but I'm wondering if many of your friends who share your love of the outdoors, the hikers and hunters and birders, are not poets. And I'm curious about this dynamic. Do most of them get it? Do they respect it? Do they ignore it?
I would say 99.8% of them certainly don't read poetry, and probably 85% of them don't read much more than, you know, Outdoor Life or Field and Stream, which is not to say that they're crude or unintelligent. Quite the opposite. They just have different fish to fry. And yet I try and picture them when I write. I try and imagine that I'm writing for them. It makes no sense at all. I know they're not going to read it. Most of them are not going to read it. There are a few who will. Somehow it keeps me grounded, and it keeps me from becoming too sort of in-crowdy. You know, I feel a lot of times that poets are writing for other poets, and I don't want to do that. I want to write as Frost did, in a way so that anybody could get something out of a poem of mine. They might not get the whole notion, but you know, they'd know where they were. They'd know who was talking. They'd know to whom he was talking. They'd know what the birds look like, what the trees look like. Well, you know, not all of these in every single poem, but I do like to imagine, you know, old folks like Creston MacArthur, long gone, God bless him. You know, he was a very, very bright guy. I mean, just an expert outdoorsman. I mean, that kind of outdoorsman that I could only ever aspire to be. You know, that was his full-time occupation. But I like to imagine that he could look at some of these poems and say, oh, yeah, I recognize that. You know, I was there, or whatever. It's an enabling device for me. It, as I say, it doesn't make any literal sense, but it makes a kind of sense for me in terms of keeping me grounded.
Yeah. So, you know, what you just said, though, it reminds me a little bit of something that I learned to cope with in doing this show, which is when I first started producing this show, which is 8 years ago now, I remember being disappointed that my friends weren't listening to it. And And then there comes a point where you realize, well, the people who are interested in it are listening to it, and they don't, you know, like your relationships aren't necessarily all with writers or with people who want to hear this show. And I think that there's a similar thing with readers. You know, it's like you're going to have certain readers, and they may or may not be the people that you have dinner with on Friday night, you know.
Right. Well, there are very few in my circle who are, you know, my really close set of intimate friends who are writers or even particularly readers or literary in any conventional sense of the term. And I don't know whether that's just by happenstance or whether in some unconscious way I've kind of sought those people out, because one of the concerns I have with a great deal of contemporary poetry, and if people think I'm a lightweight for this reason, I don't care. I'm too old to care what the smart people think. You know, this business of writing for other writers, one can somehow develop the delusion that the things that you're writing about are important to everybody out there that you pass on the street, wherein in fact they're only important to a certain select group of people who share your own artistic intentions. And I don't want to write poetry that is that hermetic. I don't want to write anything, really, that you have to learn a special language in order to understand.
Yeah.
That's why I've evolved this, as I say, this enabling fiction that my unlettered or less lettered friends will pick it up and read it. I just like to know that they could if they were so motivated, even though they won't be so motivated, if you'll allow me some circular logic.
Yeah, although I imagine every once in a while someone surprises you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That's happened a number of times, especially... you know, when I was poet laureate and visiting all these libraries, some people whom you might have imagined to be unlikely poetry readers were deeply devoted and actually keeping up with a lot of contemporary poetry just as well as I am. So
yeah.
It's a delightful surprise when that happens, yeah.
Now, you finished your term as Vermont's seventh poet laureate last year. You've handed the reins over to Char de Nord. Anyway, so were you ready? Were you ready to finish? Was it time for you to be finished?
Well, I would be lying if I said that. I was all done with that. Been there, done that, and everything. It was not, you know, the honor, which I consider significant. It wasn't the honor of being poet laureate that I liked so much. It was that being poet laureate, I was invited to any number of places within our little state. You know, I thought I knew the state from stem to stern, but I was invited to libraries in little towns I'd never heard of, and there was always somebody interesting there, and often more than one person. So I sort of missed that to some extent, but it were time to pass the torch, and the chart is a great choice.
Yeah. Okay. So we're winding down on time here, and I wondered if we could finish up with you perhaps offering some advice. I know that you are a formalist. Your poetry tends to be at least somewhat formal, maybe sometimes within your own structures that you come up with, maybe not always completely formal to what we could study in a book. But
right.
I wonder if you could offer advice for poets who might be intimidated by formalism but want to try something that's less free form.
Well, you know, I think the controversy between the free verse people and the formalists, when it gets heated, shows both sides to be incredibly dumb. You know, extraordinarily reductive things like, you know, the formalists are all you know, sort of anti-sexual, stuffy, politically reactionary, and so on. I mean, they think of all the old blues musicians from the Delta who invented the most purgeable form that we have in American song and lyric, and that doesn't seem to fit them very well. And then people, you know, the formalist or nothing people look at the free verses free verse writers and say, well, they're sloppy thinkers, and, you know, and I think, well, you know, does that apply to Adrian Rich? I wouldn't say so, you know. if I were to like only formal writers, formalist writers, I would, eliminate from my reading list some of my, perhaps most of my favorite contemporary poets. The only reason that I'm a formalist is because somehow or another, I feel more at ease, and I feel, in fact, that this seems counterintuitive, I feel more at ease and less restricted when I don't have to worry about where to break a line, you know, as in free verse. Not that I've written no free verse, but as a rule, I will come up with a kind of formal scheme that it's not a sonnet, it's not a villanelle, you know, it's not a ballad. It's a form of my own devising. And if I'm able to play around with that form, then I'm liberated from the terrible onus of having to mean something. You know, I can play around with my materials. I can say, well, the word lyrical rhymes with miracle. What'll I do with that? You know, see, I keep that rhyme going somehow or another, and see where it takes me. It's a kind of play, really. But I do think that if you want to be a poet, you ought to know as much about it as you can. And to that extent, in your early years, your apprentice years, you should be trying all kinds of poetry. You should be. I think W.H. Auden said, you know, when young people came to him with a desire to be poets, he would set them about writing, sort of imitations of other writers to see, just test their facility, their ear, and so on. He was much less concerned with whether or not they had anything original to say. He just assumed they did, because we all do. But he was interested in their applying, their practice to as wide a range of possibilities as they could. And that's the way you learn how to do something. And then for me, when I started out writing poetry, I did just that. I tried to write in every different conceivable way that I could, and then ultimately, in the 80s, I began to say, well, I'm a guy that likes, I seem to count. I may use unusual meters, but I do use meters. I tend to write in stanzas. I often like rhymes and half rhymes. There's no virtue in that. It's just what enables me to write.
Well, and there's a certain support structure to that that built-in form that you're working within. It's almost like too many choices don't feel like freedom, because there's just too much, right?
Well, that's the way it felt for me, or feels for me, when I try and write free verse. But that may be eccentric. That may be just me. But I certainly feel more at ease and oddly less confined. Things come to me and much more quickly. First drafts come to me much more quickly in regular meter, particularly tetrameter, particularly tetrameter. And I think that's probably has nothing to do with literature. Probably listened to a lot of rock and roll when I was a kid.
And jazz. You always liked jazz, so that doesn't really make sense.
Absolutely, that's a sophisticated, extension of the same interest. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Sidney Lee, I want to thank you so much. You have two books out. What's the Story? Reflections on a Life Grown Long came out last year from Green Writers Press, and your new collection of poems, No Doubt the Nameless, will be out March 1st from Four Way Books. Thank you so much again, Sid, for speaking with me. I always enjoy it.
Sheila, it is always a delight. You're a wonderful interviewer, and you make me think, so thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Sidney Lee. You can learn more about his work at sidneylee.net. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the new interview with Sidney Lee that you heard today. Write about a dream, or the memory of a dream, or the almost memory of a dream. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. And by Advance Music, a full-line music shop offering instruments and gear, audio, video design and installation, and electronic and stringed instrument repair services. You're local, we're local. Advance, it's been all about the music for more than 30 years. Located at 75 Maple Street in Burlington and online at advancemusicvt.com. And by Main Street Landing, providing daily rental space for events, meetings, conferences, and parties. Visit mainstreetlanding.com for more information or come down to the Burlington waterfront. And by Vermont Development Disabilities Council, a board led by individuals and family members that focuses on bringing Vermonters with developmental disabilities into the heart of our communities. For more information about VDDC and becoming a member, visit ddc.vermont.gov or call 888-317-2006. Let us know what you think of the show. Write the Book is almost 8 years old, as I mentioned to Sydney Lee during our conversation. It's incredible. 8 years and over 300 unique shows on the podcast site. What do you think? What would you like to see more of or less of? Who are your favorite authors? Would you like us to try to interview them? Send an email and let us know. writethebook.gmail.com is that email address. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host Gary's website is garyleemiller.com. As I said just now, please let us know what you think of the show. And if you feel moved to do so, please rate us on iTunes. Emails, ratings, and reviews are very much appreciated. Do remember that The Radiator is in Burlington thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to the podcast version of the show, which airs every Monday from 2 to 3 on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.